Hi, I'm Spencer.
And I'm Andrew.
And we're here at the Slowdown's New York headquarters. You're listening to Time Sensitive, a podcast where we profile curious and courageous people in business, the arts, and beyond who have found a distinct perspective on time.
Welcome to episode 51 of Time Sensitive. On this episode, Spencer's in conversation with artist and designer Debbie Millman, host of the Design Matters podcast and chair of the School of Visual Arts Masters in Branding program. What'd you both talk about?
So Debbie's someone I've admired for a while. She, for the past 15 years, has had this great podcast, Design Matters. It's kind of the OG of design podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
And over this period of time, what started out as kind of this maybe navel-gazy or insider-y or just sort of looking at design in a box kind of podcast has become something much more rich with guests from all walks of life.
Sort of broadens the definition of design.
Mm-hmm. And I think she's come to thinking much more about how do you explore what it means to live a creative life. That's really at the core of her podcast. And what's also interesting is that's happened to Debbie herself while she's made the podcast. She herself has been kind of exploring her own creative life, becoming a better interviewer, a better listener, somebody who really is constantly thinking about how do you make the best possible interview? So we talked about that. We also got into how she overcame incredible struggle and trauma in her childhood and eventually found a long view on love. She came out at age 50, only a couple years later, fell in love with the writer and author Roxane Gay, who she just married during the pandemic. If there's anyone who has a long view on love, but also just a great perspective on life, on work, it's Debbie.
Fantastic. This is going to be great. And now here's Spencer and Debbie.
Hi, Debbie. Welcome to Time Sensitive. Thanks for coming in today.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you.
To start, I think it's worth mentioning that we had originally scheduled this interview to take place March 23rd, 2020.
Wow. That's incredible. My brother's birthday. That's amazing.
And
wow,
of course,
I didn't realize
that. Basically 2 weeks into lockdown. How have you been thinking about this particular period of time this past, 18 months? How has it been for you?
Yeah, well, I would say it's a best of times, worst of times scenario because, well, worst of times we kind of know.
Yeah.
Best of times for me, I got married. I got married during the pandemic. I was supposed to get married much more formally with a much bigger audience on 10-10-2020, but we know what that was like.
Yep.
That didn't happen. So my wife and I went and eloped and got married in a little office complex in Encino, California.
I heard it was on instantmarriagela.com.
Yeah, which is legit, but somewhat unsophisticated.
Yeah. And so you got to quarantine with your partner, Roxane Gay.
Yes, I did. We, at that point, were engaged, but not living together.
Mm-hmm.
She has a house in LA. I have a place in New York. And so we were just going back and forth, but not spending the majority of our time together. We were able to sneak away for pockets of time, but we weren't living together officially.
Mm.
And I guess March 10th, thereabouts, we started thinking about where we should hunker down. And it seemed like it made more sense to hunker down in LA because we'd have a car and a bit more sky, a bit more land. And so I flew to LA that Saturday. I guess it was like March 15th, something like that. And I'll never forget her saying, "Pack for 2 weeks." As if we thought that's what it was going to be. And that's all I did pack for. So ended up getting a lot of underwear from Target in the ensuing weeks and ended up spending 6 months there.
Mm.
and then came back to New York for a little while, went back to LA for most of the rest of the year, and now back in New York because I'm back to teaching in person, which started 2 days ago. But quarantine, we were lucky. We both remained healthy, still are. A lot of people at the beginning were very cautiously inquiring how we were getting along because this was our first experience living together,
right.
And it was 24/7. And we were like, oh, it's great. And it was, and it has been. We got lucky. We really did.
And you're both incredibly synchronous, I guess, in the sense of your creativity and your output. How is that being in such close quarters?
It's actually fine. We parallel work. Mm-hmm. We both seem to like to work with a soundtrack of Law and Order SVU reruns in the background or HGTV. I particularly like the small town. I forgot what it's called at the moment, but the small town show. Mm. I find that the couple that does that just adorable. We now have a puppy. Mm-hmm. And so we've been spending a lot of time with him. And that was a good way for us to be able to train him effectively with all that sort of FaceTime together with him. And so she's in New York with me now, and we'll go back to LA at some point, but not exactly sure when.
Mm. And tell me about some of the projects you worked on during the pandemic. One I wanted to bring up was this Together Apart poster.
Yeah.
And signage that you did for Times Square Arts, Poster House, Print Magazine, and Four Freedoms.
Yes, that was a really important project to me at the time. There were a couple of projects that I did very early on in COVID that were either New York-centric or COVID-centric, and both felt really important and necessary to do. And it was really quite extraordinary seeing photos of the Together Apart art that I created on all the billboards in Times Square. I mean, that was surreal, especially because I am a native New Yorker. This time away from New York was the longest I've ever been away from New York in my entire life. Mm. And as I'm about to turn 60, that's a long time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So initially I was really homesick. So doing the projects that I did a project for TED, which was also one of the pieces that I did was about New York. I did something for New York by Design that felt really important. The TV show that I was on first aired New York by Design. Now it's America by Design. It's gotten bigger. But also that aired while we were in quarantine. So it was nice to sort of relive those moments being back on the streets of New York.
Mm. I'm trying to picture a young child, Debbie Millman, seeing her artwork on display in Times Square.
Surreal. Absolutely surreal.
Another project that you've been involved with that was announced in June this year is Rand Art and Data.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you could talk about that. It's a collaborative artist residency program.
Yes. So I'm working with Rand, which is a think tank, the Rand Corporation. I was invited to participate in this by my former colleague at Sterling Brands and dear, dear friend, Dee Dee Gordon. Dee Dee first came to fame, oh gosh, I want to say 20 years ago in Malcolm Gladwell's book, The Tipping Point. She was the trend hunter, the cool hunter.
Oh.
Yeah. And rumor has it that she was the vision that William Gibson had for his protagonist in the really incredible book, Pattern Recognition, that features his character, Case Pollard. That's when she first is introduced. Mm. So that's something that I'm also really excited about just in thinking about her history and her ability to understand trends and understand data. She invited me to be part of this project with Rand. And so I co-curated this with her. It launched 3 months ago with the first artist, Georgia Loopy. And we're now about to launch our second artist, Wael Marcos and Jonathan Key from Marcos Key.
And so that's a project really about challenging how we analyze data in some ways or present data.
Well, Rand presents and produces and publishes really extraordinary research reports that are very heavy on data. Mm. and not so much on the visual.
Creatively presenting the data.
Exactly. Yeah. It's very scientific. It's very official. It's very statistically significant. And they asked us to help begin to visualize this body of data that they have in a way to introduce the idea of what they do to a whole new generation of people that are much more visually oriented. And I became aware of Georgia's work many years ago when she first published a book called Dear Data. And Georgia's really been on the forefront of humanizing data. And so we were really excited to be able to work with her because the idea of humanizing the data that RAND publishes in a way that makes it not only just more interesting for people to read, but also more accessible. Mm-hmm. They have so much important information to be able to share and to share it in a way that more people can understand it is what is so exciting to me. Mm. The idea of being able to really understand income inequity or to be able to understand the ramifications of mental illness. These things are so important to me. So the idea that people can look at that data in a way and almost understand it telegraphically is pretty revolutionary.
Mm. And what was it like teaching during this period for you?
Oh my God. Initially, well, let me back up one moment and say, change for me has always been historically difficult. I'm not one of those people that is presented with a new way of living, operating, existing, and is immediately excited by the possibilities. You know, there are some people that are like that. They're like, whoa, change, awesome. I'm a very fixed personality. I love ritual. I love doing sort of this, not necessarily the same thing every day, but knowing what my day and what my week and month holds. And so the idea that within literally 48 hours, I was going to have to go from teaching in person to it's a high intensity program, 10 and a half months, 5 days a week, to a remote experience with Slack, Canvas, and Zoom. it was projectile tears, really. It took me about a month to settle into a new mode of existing because I was always so hands-on with my students, hands-on with my faculty, hands-on with my podcast, very engaged with people on a day-to-day basis, and suddenly was only able to see them in a tiny square on a tiny laptop. It was only, I guess, 2 or 3 months into the pandemic that Roxanne suggested I maybe get a bigger screen. And I thought that that maybe was a good idea, but I was still so tied to my existing laptop, my existing shortcuts, my existing keyboard that I was even reluctant to do that.
And this fall, you're publishing a book, Why Design Matters, 16 years after you started Design Matters, which initially was on the Voice America Network with with each episode airing every Friday via telephone modem in your office in the Empire State Building. Amazing.
Yes, you have done your research, sir.
16 years.
You have done your research.
16 years. You've interviewed more than 400 people. What does that period of time mean for you? How do you think about it now, the trajectory of this podcast, and how do you hope in some way maybe this book is encapsulating the conversations that you've had?
That's such a big question and something I've been pondering now for the last 2+ years that I've been working on this book. Well, in many ways, it is a monograph of the show and the work that I've done on the show. There's so many different levels and layers to deconstruct here, because on the one hand, it's a journey of evolution at hopefully getting better at something that I was really terrible at the beginning. I had a lot of passion for it. I had a lot of zeal, but not a lot of talent. And so that took time to manifest and develop and nurture. So there's that sort of aspect of it. And then there's just the notion of developing an idea. The show at the beginning, well, it's always been called Design Matters, but at the beginning it was very much a show about designers talking about design. So it was very much an inside baseball kind of niche podcast. And then over the years, and I would say it wasn't until about the 10-year mark that I started to really understand what I was trying to do. Mm-hmm. And then realized that what I was much more interested in investigating and analyzing was the arc of a person's creative life. Mm. How do they become who they are? And so it really didn't matter whether a person was a designer as long as they were a person with creative passion. Mm. So it could be even a business person or a scientist, but the way that they approach their life's work was very much as a creative engagement. And so I've interviewed now performers, musicians, playwrights, authors, scientists, biologists, Nobel Prize winners. And really, my deep fascination is to understand how people create their lives. Mm. How do they make something out of nothing over the course of their life? Mm. I find that endlessly fascinating.
One through line that you've talked about in interviews before, but I did want to bring up because I think it's fascinating and it's something that kind of happens on your podcast is this sort of nexus around the notions of confidence and courage. Mm. And I'm thinking in particular of conversations you had with both late great designers, Massimo Vignelli and Milton Glaser, but others too, this notion of confidence.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to ask, how has Design Matters influenced or impacted your own personal confidence?
Oh, that's a great question. And I love great questions because I know it's hard to construct them. Whew, I'd really like to be motivational today and say it's incredibly increased. But it really depends on the day and depends on my mood. I very much am a person that metabolizes accomplishment for good and bad. Mm. And so I'm always looking to create more, better, bigger. And I think that comes from a real deep lack of confidence. Mm. And that still exists. I think you can both hold in your being a lack of confidence in general, as well as an understanding that you might be good at one thing or two things. And that's sort of how I feel about Design Matters. And I mean, Design Matters is by no means, you know, the biggest, most important, most successful podcast on the internet, if not even by a long shot. It's just something that I know resonates with people because of the responses that I get mm-hmm. from listeners. And the one thing that I do feel strongly is that I can research. You know, I can do my research. Mm. I have good research chops. That's the only reason that I think that I can conduct a good interview, because I'm so committed to trying to understand the psyche of my guests. And in some ways, that helps fuel my conversational confidence, that I will spend weeks working on an episode just so that I feel that anywhere my guest might go in that conversation, I can follow. Mm. You know, I think conducting a good podcast, a good conversation, and a good interview means that you really, in many ways, need to let the guest lead, but you absolutely have to know how to follow. And, you know, you kind of like Ginger Rogers. You have to do everything that Fred Astaire does, but backwards.
It's so funny. I've always used the drummer analogy because in my other life, I'm actually a drummer, or play drums anyway. And so this notion of interviewer as drummer, I like, because you lay the beat, but you really let the other people kind of.
Yeah.
But if you mess up, everyone else is going to fall off the rails.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I say that a good interview is like playing a good game of billiards. Mm. You have to be able to not only get one billiard ball into the pocket, you also really want to leave the rest of the billiard balls on the table in position to continue to get the billiard balls in more pockets. It's not like tennis where you're volleying back and forth. So you really want to be able to ask a question, and wherever that guest goes, you can follow.
Mm-hmm.
And that really does require having enough knowledge about their body of work and their origin story and their journey to be able to pick up wherever they might take you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also, I think, what makes it really exciting, because you have to really listen. And that was a lesson I learned. Well, let me put it another way. That was a lesson I became aware of on my second episode way back in 2005. It's taken me a long time to learn how to do it, but I was aware that I had to on episode 2 when Cheryl Swanson, my guest, replied when I asked her how she thought I did as an interviewer. She said, well, you might want to listen to my answers before you sort of cue up the next question. I was like, yeah, I think so.
I think listening is one of your great skills and one of the reasons your podcast resonates so widely. And I'm wondering, from your perspective, what is the great impact of listening? Like, how important culturally could listening become? Because I think currently we live in an age where people are doing a lot of talking and not a lot of listening.
Yeah.
What do you think could be learned if we spent more time listening, and or at least a bit more time listening?
Well, I think you're able to connect in a more meaningful way.
Mm.
You know, one of the things that I search for and also try to teach to my students, and it's really something I aspire to in any conversation, it's not just an interview, is mutuality. And that sense that you know that I know that you know that I know that we're connecting.
Mm.
That's a palpable feeling. Like, I'm feeling it right this minute with you. And if you don't get to that, then you're missing what it really feels like to be connected to that person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can only do that with listening. For me, it's also about looking. I'm very dependent on visual cues, which was also why it was very hard early on in COVID to move the show to Zoom, because I love the intimacy of watching someone talk. It's not just listening, but also watching their body language, their hand gestures, their eyes. All that to me is so rich with information and cues and just telegraphs so much about a person. So that's also something you kind of have to do concurrently, as well as be aware of where you're going next with the questions. Because I do, like you, have paper in front of me when I'm talking. I'm not just winging it. You know, my wife is a winger. She can talk to anybody about anything with very little preparation. That's how smart she is. For me, I like to have it all there. Surprise, surprise. You know, I like that control. And so I also have to be aware of where I might want to be in that sort of script, loosely, it's a script that I prepare in advance.
Mm. Sounds about right.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like, you know, you know that we get this.
Well, there's this line by Maria Popova, the creator of the website Brain Pickings, that she writes in an afterword in your Why Design Matters book. And I wanted to read it because I found this line astoundingly beautiful and relevant to the subject of time.
Thank you. She's a wonderful writer.
An interview petrifies us in time, then lives on forever. The thoughts of bygone selves quoted back to us across the eons of our personal evolution. A strange and decomposing taxidermy diorama of life that is no longer living.
Yeah.
What a way to think about an interview.
Goosebumps. It was really funny. I was talking to Roman Mars yesterday, and we were talking about doing a little interview Q&A kind of thingy, and we were riffing on what it could possibly be. And I said, well, why don't we revisit my Design Matters episode with you like 10 years ago? And he was like, no! And what's also interesting, I took a archetype type of test. Mm-hmm. I'm preparing for an interview with Jonathan Fields, who has a book coming out called Sparked. And it's about these archetypes that he's created. And so, of course, I took the test and know what my archetype is from his analysis. And one of the things that he included in the analysis of this particular kind of person is the notion that you don't like to revisit things. Mm. You don't like to, once you've made something, revisit the making. And I realized that that is absolutely true, that once I've done an interview, it's sort of done. And it is petrified in that way. And I don't even like to listen to my voice. You either, yeah. I don't like to have to go through the experience again, because it was this one moment in time that felt perfect as is. There's no need for a repeat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that was something that I was curious about in the making of the book was, you know, did you listen to back to some of those episodes? Did you cringe? Did you laugh? Did you cry?
All of the above. I didn't listen, though. What I did was I had them all transcribed. Mm. I had about, I would say, half of my episodes transcribed. I've done about 450 or so at this point.
Wow. Yeah.
So I think I had about 200 and something transcribed. Mm. And then I read them all. And there were moments of excruciating agony. Like, how is it possible that anybody still listens to the show after reviewing the transcripts? Mm. But there were also some surprises and things that I was really happy about finding and understanding the growth, you know, and just seeing the sort of tangible evidence of one's improvement, however slight. But it's there. And so it was interesting having to decide what kinds of interviews I wanted to have in the book, because I want this to be a book that feels timeless. Yes, those interviews are petrified, but I also want them to have some sort of emotional timbre that feels like it could be anyone at any time experiencing anything, because it's so universal. And so because it was so difficult to edit how many interviews were going to be included, given the extraordinary number of guests that I've had and really brilliant guests, the first cut was, is this timeless? Does this offer something universal that anyone can pick up and read and say, wow, that's what it means to be human. It's not so much about a specific book or a specific play or a specific piece of music. It's really very much about an emotional experience that someone has being who they are that other people can read and relate to.
Well, I think an interview at its best kind of gets at that. And sure, it might be pegged to a book coming out or this or that, but it's ultimately the meat of the interview is that. It's the human part. When you're listening to Terry Gross, when you're listening to Krista Tippett, like, their interviews are the best when they get to that essential.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a funny story about Krista Tippett. So Krista Tippett, before COVID, was the last interview that I did studio to studio.
Oh.
Every other interview I've done since Krista, and the majority of my interviews, were face-to-face. But after Krista, I made a decision that I was no longer doing any interviews studio to studio. Unlike Terry Gross, who doesn't like to look at people when she does her interviews.
Yeah, fascinating.
I have to. I had decided at that point, and I've really passed up some incredible opportunities. I still kind of kick myself that I let some of those go, given how moving to Zoom has been okay and didn't kill me. But after Krista, I decided that I was no longer doing studio to studio. And it is because when Krista and I were talking, we were ostensibly there to talk about her book, Becoming Wise. But of course, we talked about her whole life. One thing I was particularly interested in at that time was her experience with depression. I had recently gone through a period of depression. She had gone through a period of depression. And so we talked about that. It was a very heartfelt, very honest conversation. At the end of the interview, I got my show notes from my producer, and he said, I really wish you would have asked her how she came out of her depression. Mm. And I'm like, what? I didn't ask her how she, oh my God. And I knew that if I had been looking at her face to face, that I would have been able to pull that out.
Mm.
Okay, fast forward several years. I am now going through my transcripts, and I have now changed fundamentally my rules about how I'm conducting interviews, only face-to-face. I'm looking at my transcript with Krista, and what do I find? Krista, how did you come out of your depression? And I was like, how did Curtis miss that? And he was just not paying attention in that moment in time. But that one thing that he said to me really propelled me to consider only doing the interviews face-to-face. And because I had just started doing them via Zoom, it did give me, again, the confidence, in quotes, to try it again and just be that much more careful about listening.
Well, from the start, one of the things Andrew and I talked about was how important it is that every guest sits in the same chair, in the same room, and gets to experience the space and the sound and the feeling of being in this room.
Yeah. Which is a beautiful room, by the way.
And hopefully comes through in the audio.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because Tim Ferriss wrote the introduction and he talks about what it's like to be in my studio, because I've interviewed Tim now, I don't know, 3 or 4 or 5 times. Mm. And two of those times he's been in the studio, in my studio, and he talks about it in the introduction, what it's like being in this little dark room with Debbie, you know? This sort of intimacy that is experienced because it was also pre-COVID. I sat very close to my guest. We're in a very tight and enclosed room. And I do think in the same way that the airy, beautiful light, the sense of cleanliness and style and beauty that exists in your studio very much reflects you, the sort of cramped, dark, intimate studio. It sort of indicates my approach to getting into somebody's head somehow.
Well, with Tim, it's clear that you guys have formed together a profound connection and been equally vulnerable on each of your podcasts.
Yeah. Tim is my brother from another mother.
So this fall, you're turning 60.
I am.
What does this particular milestone mean to you? I know you've talked about how you're much more aware of time now.
I am. I didn't really start thinking about age and mortality at all until I was 49. And when I turned 50, it was, I think crisis is probably too strong a word, but definitely a comeuppance. Okay, what am I doing with my life? Why am I doing these things this way? Mm-hmm. And by 55, I had radically changed my life. Radically. I came out. I sold my business. Everything about my life was different. Where I lived, where I worked, how I loved, everything. And now it's another decade. And the if not now, when mantra is constant. And having now gone through or in the midst of this pandemic, seeing really how fragile life is. We recently had a death in our family, somebody very important to us, not COVID related, but tragic. And that constant clarion call of what do we make of our lives? What do we make of ourselves? What do we leave behind? That to me is the biggest and most pressing questions of my life right now.
I want to go back to the beginning.
Okay.
But before we do, I did want to bring up this Ezra Pound quote that you finished your book Look Both Ways with. And it's, we do not know the past in chronological sequence. It may be convenient to lay it out on the table with dates passed on here and there, but what we know by ripples and spirals eddying out from us and from our own time. It's a great quote on time, one I hadn't come across before. And it reminds me, sort of thinking about, you know, Robert Smithson's Spiral Jetty, and kind of just thinking about time as a coil, not as a straight line.
Have you seen the movie Arrival?
I haven't.
Oh, I am so about to change your life. That is a magnificent movie, and it's about the circularity of time, or the possibility that time is circular. And it's really a beautiful, beautiful movie. I can watch that movie over and over and still find new things in it. It's a remarkable movie, and I think you'll love it if you love thinking about time and analyzing the nature of the way time moves. You will love this movie.
Guess I know what I'm doing this weekend.
And then you have to tell me what you think.
Okay. Well, I wanted to bring that quote up just because I think even how the way this conversation is going to go, it's not a linear straight line. And your life certainly hasn't been, although there's all these interesting parallels from your youth to your adulthood and the way your life is connected. So let's go back to your youth.
Okay.
You're a native New Yorker, born in Brooklyn. You grew up in Howard Beach, Queens, lived in Staten Island. Then when your parents divorced, you moved with your mom to Long Island. Your father was a pharmacist. Your mother was a seamstress and a painter. Now that I've laid all that out, tell me about your relationship with your parents and just kind of growing up, your childhood. I know you've described it as a DIY upbringing.
Yeah, I mean, it was, and the older I get, the sort of more amazed that I came out of it, even remotely intact. It was turbulent. You know, my parents, between them, have been married 7 or 8 times, I think. My father died 6 years ago. They were both really complicated people and were way too young to have children. My mother was 18. My father was 21. They were babies, and babies shouldn't have babies. And they were so busy trying to figure out who they were. They didn't know how to take care of kids. And so my brother and I, my brother's 2.5 years younger than I am, we're very close. But we've only become close in the last 10 or so years. There were years where we were estranged just because everybody in my family was estranged. Everyone. There is no one in my family, no one, that speaks to my mother. My mother's been married 4 times, has adopted children from other marriages, so altogether 6. No one speaks to her. I'm the only one that has even the remote kind of contact with her, and it's very infrequent because she became a Trumper. She's a born-again Jew for Jesus. She thought Trump was the prophecy. Doesn't want to wear a mask because she thinks that, you know, if we were meant to wear masks, we'd be born with them. When I told that to my shrink, she very aptly replied without blinking, what about clothes? You know, so that's hard for me, super hard for me. She also doesn't believe in or doesn't think that being gay is, you know, normal, I guess, is the word she would use. So that's all really hard for me. And I've really tried to see what she sees. But it's just when it got to the Trump part, I couldn't anymore. So that was really, really hard. You know, hearing her say Trump is the prophecy, I was like, no, he's not, Mom. No, he's not.
As a kid in real time, how did you deal with this sort of difficult, traumatic thing in front of you?
I don't think you understand when you're a little person that your parents are clinically mentally ill, which they both were. You worship your parents. You want them to love you. My father was extremely, extremely turbulent, very volatile. And so I didn't know when he was going to be in a good mood or a bad mood. And so I was always on eggshells and always afraid. Mm. And that's hard to live like that. And then as I got older, when I was 10, after my parents got divorced, my mother remarried. And, you know, this part, people know it, that might have listened to my interviews with Tim. She married a man who sexually, physically, and emotionally abused me for years. And had to figure out how to put the pieces back together as an adult. And now feel that understanding of what I went through has helped me in my work with the Joyful Heart Foundation and trying to eradicate domestic violence, sexual assault, and child abuse in our culture, on our planet. Mm. And that's something I'm very committed to doing. And even in the work we're doing now in eradicating the rape kit backlog is making a huge difference in people understanding how culture responds to sexual violence is indicative of how culture responds to women.
Mm.
And so that work is really important to me, and I'm proud of that work. It's really in many ways made my life make sense. And that's something I first disclosed to Tim.
You mentioned this period when you're around 10 or 11 years old, and I understand you also had a sort of speech dysfunction.
It was, I don't know if I would go quite as far as that. I think in thinking about it more recently, I think it might have been more of a reaction to what I was experiencing. It only lasted about a year, and it wasn't so much an impediment. I think it was more of a psychological disorder. I suddenly did not understand the validity of reality, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And so whenever anybody would ask me, for example, an innocuous question like, how are you? I wouldn't know what to say. So I would say, and maybe it was kind of an accurate thing, but it sounded crazy. I would say, well, maybe I'm okay, but maybe I'm not. Mm. Because at any moment, anything could change. If somebody would say, are you hungry? I would say, well, maybe I am and maybe I'm not. So everything was maybe yes, maybe no. I couldn't commit to anything being that moment's accuracy. And so somebody might say, oh, what's the weather like in New York? You know, my grandmother lived in Florida. What's the weather like? Well, maybe it's nice out, but maybe it's not. Well, is the sun out or not? So everybody was super concerned that there was something really wrong with me.
But it was just a kid who was traumatized, recoiling,
yes,
really.
Yeah, it was. And what's interesting is that I'll never forget the day that it stopped.
Mm.
My stepfather, the mean man who abused me, so he had two children from his previous marriage, put my brother and I and his two children through this nightly torture, which he called inspection. And every night he would inspect our rooms to make sure that they were spick and span. And everything had to be in order. And one day he did an inspection on my room, and somehow, unbeknownst to me, a skirt had fallen off a hanger in my closet and was laying on the floor of my closet in a little heap. And he opened the door to my closet and saw the skirt there. And he was furious with me. Why is the skirt on the floor? And I said, I don't know. I didn't do it. It must have fallen by itself. And my mother and my stepfather were furious with me. And I remember, as if it were yesterday, them saying, how can you be so sure? You can't even be sure if it's raining out. You're telling us that for sure this was on the hanger when you closed your closet? And I was like, yes.
Gravity.
Right?
When I was reading about your childhood and also listening to you describe it on a couple different podcasts, I was fascinated to learn about how you sort of created these markers of time during those years, visual markers of time, like when your mom told you and your brother that she was divorcing your father, she took you to go see Hello, Dolly. And so you have this image from Hello, Dolly and the beats in the film.
I've just begun to start enjoying Beats, by the way.
Amazing.
But yeah, when I saw Bette Midler on Broadway and that line came up in the play, I was sitting, I think, in the second row, and I was just weeping, hearing it again and sort of having it become a new marker.
Mm. And music seems to be kind of a big part of your life, not just your childhood, but your life and sort of in terms of marking time.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk about this oral fixation and how sound and music relates to how you relate to particular moments in time in your life?
I think I use music as a marker, and I get so involved in whatever new music comes out that I'm immersed in, that it becomes almost synchronous to the time.
Mm.
And so that first listen, music moves me so deeply that that first listen or that first experience will become sort of embedded in my neural pathways, I think. And because I'm a person that when I love something new, I'll listen to it over and over and over again until it sort of becomes part of my DNA, that when I then move on to something else, but then hear it again or play it again, it brings me back to that moment very viscerally. Mm. And I kind of love that. I mean, that really is a very circular way of thinking about time, because it literally does bring me back to that moment.
Mm.
And I can associate it with so many things. It's not just the air or the time or the place. It's what I was wearing or what I was eating. You know, there are so many different connections to it.
I know in high school you were interested in musical theater.
Yeah.
Were you actually playing any instruments or just singing? Or?
Well, those were the dark years. So there really wasn't any opportunity to take piano lessons or guitar lessons. So I tried to teach myself very rudimentarily. So I can play, you know, Neil Young chords on a guitar, and that's about it. And I can play, you know, Chopsticks and Do a Deer and Heart and Soul on the piano. But I did very much want to work in musical theater, and was in all of the school plays and sang and danced and did everything that one does when you're in high school in Godspell. And I look back in those days at those moments thinking, you know, that saved my life. Mm. That ability to express myself, to feel part of something bigger than I was, to be able to get out of the house, to be able to stay out of the house every day for play rehearsal. And all of those things were so important to who I am today,
mm.
whether or not I'm an actual, you know, musical theater person. I still go to musical theater a lot.
And what sort of impact did having your brother around have on you?
Well, my brother only lived with us until he was 13.
Mm.
When he was 13, he gave my mother an ultimatum. Either her boyfriend, who she was with at the time, she didn't ever marry him, but he was in our lives for a very long time. Either he goes or my brother is going to go live with my father.
Mm.
And my mother said she couldn't make that decision. So my brother went to live with my father.
Mm.
And his relationship with my mother never recovered from that. There was a few attempts, but never recovered. And my dad, unfortunately, I still don't fully understand why, but he was only able to have compartmentalized relationships with his kids one at a time,
mm.
or two at a time. There was never a time when he got remarried and had two more boys, so I have three brothers. There was never a time in our lives ever, ever, where he was talking to all of us.
Mm.
When he died, he wasn't talking to three of us by his decision. And so in the time that my brother was an adolescent and then a teenager growing up, and I was in my 20s, and as we grew up, we kind of took turns being in touch with our dad. He couldn't ever have a relationship with both of us at the same time, which made it very difficult for us to have relationships at the same time, because he didn't want us to be in relationship with the other that he wasn't in relationship with.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it was really, really turbulent. It really wasn't until my brother decided he couldn't live like this anymore and pulled himself out of the relationship with my dad, and I decided I wasn't going to sacrifice my relationship with my brother, and my father would just have to manage his own emotions, knowing that we were in contact, despite the fact that they weren't, that we were able to solidify, finally, a really deep and strong relationship. And now that he has children, that's been a tremendous constant in all of our lives, my being a constant in their lives, which is really important to us all.
I wanted to transition a little bit, not fast forwarding too much, to your career in branding and design.
Sure.
And I found it fascinating when researching that you engaged in branding and graphics quite early on. Your dad had a pharmacy.
Yeah.
And, you know, in your book, Brand Thinking, you note that your life has been shaped by brands. When did the notion of a brand enter your psychology? And then when did you decide, oh, this is actually a career?
I would say that brands first entered my psychology when I became obsessed with Goody Barrettes when I was a little girl. My father had a spinning stand in his pharmacy filled with the barrettes, headbands, ponytail holders. And I just thought that was the most magical thing in the world. And I loved collecting them. I actually once stole one from a friend, which I write about in Look Both Ways, which to the, my dying day will be a shame spiral. but I suddenly became aware of things outside of me that could enhance me by the virtue of their proximity.
Mm.
And so barrettes could make me feel prettier. When I got to high school, all the cool kids were wearing Levi's jeans and Lacoste polo shirts. And I thought, well, if I have that same uniform, maybe I'll be accepted and a cool kid too. So suddenly these external elements could camouflage a very insecure spirit. And taking those objects on or in was a way for me to, in that moment, because, you know, I know now what's really happening. It was a fairly fleeting experience, but in the moment, I would feel better about myself. And so that's when I began to sort of nascently, not consciously, realize the power that brands have over people, because they had so much power over my psyche and how I, and my own sense of self. But I didn't know that that was a career, nor did I have any understanding of the psychology behind anything I'm saying now. I just knew I felt better. I felt a little bit cooler when I was wearing Levi's. My first decade in my professional career was as a designer. I ended up in branding quite by accident, having sort of failed out of every role that one could have in design agencies between my 20s and early 30s. I ended up a salesperson at a branding consultancy as sort of a Hail Mary to be able to pay my rent. And at that point, because I was doing business development and didn't know how much I knew about the psychology of branding, I suddenly was, oh my God, I have this like magic toolbox of things that I know and feel and can experience and share. And then I found my calling professionally.
I mean, that time in the pharmacy must have been so formative.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I worked in my dad's pharmacy. When I was in college, I would hitchhike. I know. Don't even. I would hitchhike. Yeah. So there you have it. My father and my relationship in a nutshell. He wanted me to go work for him on the weekends and I'd hitchhike to his store on the highway in the 80s. I would hitchhike and get to his store and work on the weekends to help him and also make a few bucks. That experience was probably better than college in terms of understanding branding and understanding why people choose the things they do and how they do and how they spend money on commodities and how they choose things that might embarrass them or they might need to feel better or the relationship people have with pharmaceuticals and at the time cigarettes and everything that he sold in his store. And suddenly I was touching everything and serving and making change and doing everything that one does to serve someone buying something. That's an education.
Yeah, distilling the paradox of choice.
Absolutely.
When it comes to time, particularly related to branding, I did want to talk quickly about this sort of long sweep evolution of branding, this sort of notion of, as you describe it in a TED Talk, like Lascaux to Facebook. You know, I don't think most people realize how nascent in many ways the notion of how we perceive a modern day brand is so young. I mean, as you've pointed out, January 1, 1876 was the advent of the Trademarks Registration Act.
Right.
It's not even 200 years.
Correct.
So how do you think about brand in relationship to time and speed and contemporary society and the notion of how we perceive and understand a brand or branding today?
Brands are symbols that signify whatever we imbue in them, whatever we project in them. And one of the examples that I cite in the TED Talk is something that we all perceive horrifically now, which is the swastika. Hitler appropriated the swastika. The word swastika comes from the Sanskrit word svastika, which stands for good luck and fortune. And Hitler appropriated that mark prior to his doing that. That mark was on material that the Boy Scouts created. It was on road signs. It was on good luck poker chips. It was on playing cards. It was on cookies. Coca-Cola used to make a bottle opener. So we project characteristics into symbols and then through consensus agree on what those symbols mean. Mm-hmm. So we now all agree that that mark, the swastika, is a mark of cruelty and evil. But 100 years ago, it was considered a mark of good luck only because of what we projected and associated with it. If you look at the Nike swoosh, the Nike swoosh upside down is the Newport Cigarettes logo. It's also very close in appearance to the Capital One logo. Mm-hmm. It's not the mark so much, it's the marketing. And the marketing is the way in which we manufacture meaning. So we've done that since the beginning of time. Some of our oldest symbols as a species are religious symbols. And those religious symbols are really no different. You can't necessarily go into a supermarket and buy that symbol, but you can certainly go into a place of worship and experience that symbol in the same way you might go into an Apple store and experience the Apple logo. So the tenets are very, very similar. And this is a way for us to organize reality and organize information. And it allows us to be able to telegraphically communicate. It allows us to telegraphically understand safe or unsafe. And it allows us to communicate very effectively without having to speak the same language or understand the same conditions.
I was fascinated to learn also that the word brand is derived from the Old Norse word brander, which means to burn by fire.
To mark or destroy by fire. Yeah. Cattle ranchers began to use that word to signify the mark by fire, which is originally how cattle were branded. It was only later in time or more recently that, well, first pine tar was used, then fire to mark the cattle. And now you'll often see the plastic hooks that are attached to cattle ears so that if they run away from the pack can be more easily found.
I mean, the notion of burning and relationship to branding is fascinating on so many levels. When you were 12, you created a magazine called Debutante.
My friend Debbie Karp. I still maintain that that is a great name for a magazine, and I believe it's still available for anyone that wants it.
And you were later editor of the arts and features section of the SUNY Albany newspaper, where you were an English major. Did you have literary aspirations, journalistic aspirations? And when did graphic design and branding kind of come into the picture for you? Was it an outgrowth of the work you were doing at the newspaper? Or?
Yes. I majored in English. I minored in Russian literature. I always joke now that I have a college degree in reading. Very, very useful. When I was a senior, I was the arts and features editor of the student newspaper. And as part of the duties of the editor, you also had to put the paper together, which in terms today, we'd say you have to design it. And at the time, it was really basic layout and paste up, but I fell madly in love with doing it and really enjoyed doing that more than anything else. And so when I graduated, I really had two different skill sets. I had an editorial skill set that I had developed while being editor of the paper, but I also had a very limited graphic design skill set where I could do basic layout and paste up on drafting tables. And my very, very first job out of college was doing that. I was sort of a traffic girl between the editorial department and the art department at a cable magazine, which was all the rage back then. And this was 1983. And so I would work specking type and I would be editing and fitting little copy descriptions into boxes with little pictures of Dustin Hoffman and Jessica Lange in Tootsie, which was a big movie at that time, and things like that.
One of your early jobs I wanted to bring up was as the off-air creative director of Hot 97.
Yes, yes.
Which you haven't talked a lot about. And I just wanted to kind of hear, how did this job come about? What was that experience like working on the identity and graphics for what was the first ever hip-hop station?
Yeah, it was an amazing, amazing experience. So my last job at a graphic design studio before I went into branding was at a company called Frankfurt Ballkind. Actually, when I was there, it was called Frankfurt Gips Ballkind. And this was a job that really kind of pushed me out of graphic design. That was what led to my Hail Mary into branding, and really more as a salesperson than a creative person. When I was at Frankfurt Gips Ballkind, one of my prior clients at an agency that I'd been at before Frankfurt Gips Ballkind called me and told me that his wife, Helene Gold, worked at a radio station and they were looking to do a redesign and rebrand. And could they come into Frankfurt Gips Ballkind, who was very well known for doing entertainment design, to see if perhaps Frankfurt Gips Ballkind can do the redesign?
Mm.
So the entire marketing team at Hot 97 came in, led by a phenomenal woman named Judy Ellis and her right-hand person, who is named Rocco McRae. Neither one work there now. They came in, and the head of accounts, Harriet Ballkind, who was the wife of Aubrey Ballkind, one of the partners, Aubrey's wife, Harriet, and Judy didn't get along. Like, you could see, it was like one of those like hate at first sight kind of moments. So I was crestfallen because I would have loved to have worked with Hot 97 and thought it was such a cool project. They didn't really think so at Frankfurt Gips Ballkind, and nothing happened. Shortly thereafter, I left Frankfurt Gips Ballkind, and Steve Gold, my friend whose wife worked at Hot 97, called me again and said, "I see you've left. Do you want to do this on your own?" And I was like, "Hell yeah." And I did for 12 years. Mm. For 12 years, I was the off-staff creative director at Hot 97, worked with Rocco McRae and Johann Vipper and Judy, of course, Judy Ellis, to launch the world's first hip-hop radio station. And it was an extraordinary, extraordinary experience.
And such a definitive touchstone of New York.
Absolutely. And Angie Martinez, who became a very, very popular DJ on Hot 97, at the time was Judy Ellis's secretary. And we had no money to do anything. And we were looking for models to help launch the radio station. And so we did an open call at the radio station, on the radio. Steve Gold had a lot of connections in the club world. So we did an open call at the Palladium, or maybe it was Area. I don't even remember the tunnel. I don't remember one of the big clubs at the time. We did an open call. We got listeners involved and we did a photo shoot with the listeners, the actual listeners of Hot 97, that really portrayed the demographic that we were going after. And that's how the whole thing happened. Angie, Judy's secretary, was in that first set of ads And then slowly but surely, she started doing some DJ work on the radio and then ended up basically being their most popular DJ for years and years and years. Mm. And then when that ad campaign first launched, there was no such thing as going viral at the time, but it went viral. It ended up on the cover of New York Newsday saying sexy buses, sexy subways, because they were all bus and subway ads. And there were all these like really sexy hip hop people and no one knew what to make of it. And the whole city was in an uproar. It was phenomenal.
Were you involved in the identity?
I worked with Say Adams. There was an identity that existed when we all started. Mm-hmm. Say Adams, the remarkable designer, graffiti artist, Say Adams did that first redesign. Mm-hmm. And then many years later, I worked on the second redesign at Sterling Brands because then, full circle, when I went to Sterling, I brought Hot 97 with me and did the work there with some remarkable designers at Sterling.
So yeah, 20 years at Sterling, you have this really incredible run there. You worked on teams that created identities for 7-Up, Tropicana,
Burger King.
Twizzlers. You did branding and packaging for all kinds of snacks and pharmaceuticals. Again, full circle. And you've described yourself during this period as a successaholic.
Did I?
Yeah.
That's a good word.
Sort of this idea, I guess, that you started to feel like as much work as you were doing, there was still sort of a creative soul within you that was dying. So you're making all this work. And then what? So how did you find your way back to fulfilling your creative urges?
After Frankfurt Balkan, I went to a company called the Schecter Group, which while I was there was subsumed by Interbrand. And I worked at Interbrand for a very short time. When I was at the Schecter Group and we were folded into Interbrand by Omnicom, most of the staff left en masse. And at one point, I was one of maybe three or four or five people from the original staff of the Schecter Group working at Interbrand. Mm. And it was a really strange political time in the agency, given this sort of merging of two cultures, two staffs, just was very difficult. And I was used to difficult, but this was on a whole other level because of the public nature of the company. You know, company was a publicly traded company. It was on a completely different level. And so I ended up calling a headhunter, Roz Goldfarb, who connected me to Sterling. Mm. And I remember my boss at the time telling me that I was going on a suicide mission with my career going to Sterling because Sterling was just coming out of bankruptcy. But I was so desperate. I needed to make money. I needed to take care of myself that I needed to find a secure position. And I got hired at Sterling, also again, doing business development. I was very good at it at Interbrand and Schecter, continued becoming even better at it. And very quickly, in a matter of 18 months, was appointed president of the agency because of how successful I was at bringing in business. Here I am, 33, 34 years old. For the first time in my life, I am professionally successful and making money. I could not believe my good fortune. And because it was so life-affirming at the time for me to have the success, that's all I wanted to do. I just wanted to do something I was successful at 24/7. I was so used to failing, so used to rejection, so used to strife that here I was bringing in the biggest accounts I'd ever worked on. I was like Michael Jordan in a zone. You know, I just could not miss a basket. And that's all I wanted to do. It was like, let's just give up everything else because this feels so good all the time. And that's what I did for about 8 years. And within 13 years, we were able to sell the company. So clearly, you know, I did well, and I'm so grateful for that experience. But in that 8 year mark, I started to realize that I was kind of dying inside a little bit. There was just everything was commercial. Everything was about a return on investment. Everything was about shelf presence. Everything was about market share position. And, you know, I was a girl that used to love to do needlepoint and draw and write dumb poetry and crummy, you know, drawings of whatever. So it just, I had come a long way from that and wanted a little bit of it back. Mm. And that's sort of when I started writing again. And that's when that fateful day when I got that cold call from Voice America, do I want to do a radio show? I was like, why not? You know, this could be creative and I can maybe also merge it with business and I can kill two birds with one stone. And that's really what I did.
Mm. I want to finish on the subject of love.
Okay.
You've had two divorces, one in your 20s, one in your 30s. And then at 50 came out. And in 2018, at last, met Roxane Gay. If ever there were a long view on love, I think it would have to be yours. Tell me a bit about this journey, which I listened to the episode podcast that Brené Brown did with Roxane and you, and she described it as a proper rom-com, and I have to agree. I mean, I really think that there could be a whole episode beyond what she discussed with you guys. So I just wanted to get into this. Like, how are you thinking about your life, these different periods of time, and your sort of long view path to love?
Well, you could only really appreciate a long view when you've been alive for a long time. And given how much research you've done to prepare for this interview today, I'm sure you've heard my repeating David Lee Roth's comment about what it means to peak.
Mm-hmm.
And so for your listeners, I'll share it because it's really one of the most profound things that I have been gifted on Design Matters. When I interviewed David Lee Roth, I asked him what it felt like in 1984 to be the most popular dude on the planet. 1984, I was 1 year living in Manhattan. I was there for the birth of MTV. I watched Jump, their video, 4,368 times that first year, and knew the power that Van Halen had back in the day. You know, that moment in the Jump video when David Lee Roth and Eddie Van Halen are sort of riffing together and you see David's little dimples and they're smiling together. I mean, that was a moment that really solidified a generation. And they were so popular. I know you're a lot younger than me, so I know you couldn't possibly remember what that moment was like. But Van Halen was, you know, they were the it band of the moment all over the world. And I asked him what that felt like. What did that feel like? What can that possibly feel like? How could you explain what that feels like to me? And his answer really surprised me. And he said, you have to be really careful when you get to the top, the tippy top of the tallest mountain. Because when you get to that top, you're almost always alone. It's always cold and there's only one direction. And so he cautioned those in a rush to peak. And in that moment, I felt seen. It's like, okay, I don't want to peak until the day before I die. And so that long view, again, once you've lived a fairly long life, suddenly feels doable. And it feels aspirable, if that's a word. Because the last thing I would like to think is I did my best work in my 20s. Or my 30s, or my 40s, or even my 50s. I love making things so much, and I love being in a place where I can, you know, intellectually, physically, emotionally make something. That's when I'm happiest. That the idea that somehow that would dissipate over time is terrifying to me. And so having the long game in mind and not rushing to accomplish everything anymore, but taking those small steps is a lot more gratifying now than it was in my 20s when I thought it would never happen and I was doomed. So as far as love is concerned, honestly, I have to say I just got lucky. There's no philosophical tidbit that I could provide other than the year before I met Roxanne, I was suffering from heartbreak. I very intentionally took myself off the market. I did not want to be involved. I didn't want to be in a relationship. I had always been a serial monogamist and jumped from one relationship to another. Oftentimes there was some slight overlap and didn't want to live that way anymore. And so for the nearly 2 years that I was single before Roxanne, I was in a self-imposed singleness. You know, I would not allow myself to do that because I felt that I needed to break the pattern of depending on somebody else for my happiness or my self-worth or my pleasure or anything. And so when Roxanne finally acquiesced to going out with me, because it was quite a long campaign to get her to pay attention to me.
Originally as asking her to come on your podcast.
Yes. Yes. But when I did that, I do have to say, quite honestly, it wasn't for seductive purposes. It really was. I was so moved by reading Hunger that I felt like I was reading my own diaries and needed to connect with her about it, and kept writing her about Hunger and kept quoting the book back to her. And
it was intellectual love.
Yeah, it was. It absolutely was. But then once we did start dating, I also didn't push, because that's how sure I was we were supposed to be together, that I wanted her to find out in her own time. Like, I never asked her for her phone number. She only wanted to communicate via email. Fine, we'll communicate via email. If she doesn't want to text with me, we don't have to text. Until she wants to give me her phone number, I will be emailing her. And I've never did that before. I was always like, "What? How can we move it to the next level? How can we get to the next place? How can we? And was really impatient and always pushed to solidify the relationship as fast as possible so that I would feel secure, which is not really good for a relationship. And so here I just tried to let it unfurl in the way that I knew in my heart it would. And it did.
And it sounds like, I might be wrong, but it sounds like in your career, you've also come to a sort of similar place where it's okay to say no. It's okay to be a little more patient with what you take on, what you decide to do.
You're smiling because I'm smiling, and that's a work in progress. It's still really hard for me. You know, I remember when I got my first book deal, you have had to think like a great graphic designer in front of you. And I still maintain that that's the worst book title of any book in the history of all books. Nevertheless, the reason that that's the title it is, even though that's not really what the book is even about, is because I was so afraid to push back. I was so afraid to say no, because I thought if I said no, I'd never, ever get another book deal again. This was it. This was my only chance in life to write a book. And I was able to persuade the publisher to let me have content that was different from the title, and the title would be seen more as a tongue-in-cheek kind of, as if there is ever a way to think like a great graphic designer kind of thing. But people still on Amazon will be like, this book isn't what it says it is in the title. Like, it's supposed to be ironic. In any case, I've mostly approached everything like that. Like, this is my last chance for love, my last chance for a book, my last chance for success, my last chance. And it's only now that I do feel like one notch more confident about my ability to recreate another opportunity, not so much the success part that I always feel like I have to earn. Working on it. Still time.
Debbie, it was so great to have you, and thank you for
joining. This has been a remarkable conversation, and I just want to thank you from like the bottom of my heart, which is such a weird thing to say, but it is really how I feel. Like, I just feel very open-hearted in telling you how much I appreciate this conversation.
18 months overdue.
Thank you.
Thanks, Debbie.
Thank you for listening. You can find more episodes of Time Sensitive on our website, timesensitive.fm, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And be sure to check out our other podcast, At a Distance, by heading to atadistancepodcast.com. You can now find all of our projects in one place on our website, slowdown.tv. Our theme music was composed by Billy Martin. This episode was produced by Tiffany Zhao, Emily Jang, Mike Lala, and Pat McCusker.